You're listening to Broadcast APA's podcast series for our book, Green Community, co-published with the National Building Museum. In this series, we're speaking with some of the 23 contributors about the complexities of Green Community. I'm Timothy Minnell, senior editor of APA's Planner's Press and co-editor of our new publication, Green Community, co-published with the National Building Museum on the occasion of its exhibition of the same title. This is another in our series of podcasts with some of the contributors to the book. I'm totally delighted to have three of the contributors from the Density and Transportation section of the book here today: F. Cade Benfield, Fred Hansen, and Mariella Alfonso. I'll introduce them all briefly, and then we'll get into the discussion. Cade Benfield is director of the Smart Growth Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. He has authored or co-authored many publications, including Smart Growth in a Changing World and Solving Sprawl. Fred Hansen is general manager of TriMet, the regional transit authority in the Portland, Oregon metro area. He chairs the American Public Transportation Association's Sustainability Task Force. And Mariella Alfonso is a postdoctoral fellow at the Metropolitan Institute at Virginia Tech in the Department of Urban Affairs and Planning. Welcome, all three of you.
Thank you.
Density and transportation encompasses so much, and it's very much at the heart of what we think of when we talk about a given community. You know, what's there, how you get there, and what's ultimately how we feel about places. Cade, you, in your piece for the book, you talk a lot about the sort of golden age of transportation and the way it made people feel about getting around and where they lived and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that's changed in, you know, as we've come to face these new challenges of, in a world focused more on sustainability?
Well, I think for a lot of us it has changed. If we go back to the days in which some of us at least were young in the 1960s or 1970s, driving was pretty much the way we got around to go anywhere in most of the country, unless we lived in a very, very large city. And not many of us did in terms of the percentage of the population as a whole. And it really wasn't that hard to get from one place to another, but now it's gotten very hard. Just looking at the numbers, we lose something like $78 billion a year to being stuck in traffic congestion, and the environmental costs associated with all the driving that we do as our population has grown and as our suburbs have sprawled out so that things are farther and farther apart, driving has become more of an inconvenience than a convenience. And one of the things that a green community needs to do is to address that, both to make life better for the people who will inhabit that community and to reduce its environmental impact.
Fred, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about maybe a specific case of the general phenomenon that Cade's alluding to. What are some of the things going on in Portland that are related to this?
Well, I think first and foremost is that we do not think of transportation and specifically public transit as only about getting people from point A to point B. Rather, it's about community. It's about creating places that people want to live, that they want to be able to have choices in how they get around. And as Cade said, the auto-dependent only choice is something we in the Portland region are really trying to give people a different approach. That is, we want to have them have choices, whether it is to be able to walk, to bike, or to be able to take public transit, or for some trips to be able to utilize that car. But it's really about building communities that make people want to be able to have different options for their travel. And that's something that we have seen in this region over the past decade. The result has been significant. Our average trips have reduced in length as people have found ways to be able to make more of their trips by alternative modes. And then secondly, we also are seeing that we're one of the few places in the nation where our vehicle miles traveled are actually not growing as fast as either our population or our transit use.
That is unusual. Now, Mariella, your work focuses on megapolitan development, at least for this publication. which I take to mean, you know, tremendous density, tremendous growth, and the challenges that, that come with it. Can you situate your work in this discussion a little bit?
Yes, I mean, we talk about the fact that the trend is really towards megapolitan growth, which is we define as super regions that combine at least two or more metropolitan areas. And we try to address the fact, well, how do you then balance sustainable growth in light of the fact that most of our growth really is in the form of megapolitan growth? But we make the argument that megapolitan growth doesn't necessarily have to indicate or lead to more sprawl. And this is because we believe that both the paths within this growth that connect the nodes of activity will really have to adapt to kind of the new sustainability and energy needs that are we're currently experiencing. But they're also going to be adapting to changing patterns of demographics and preferences for where we want to live as communities much more required almost by the new generation of people that are looking to buy homes. So, and the good news is that a lot of this type of development is already underway in terms of these, you know, new types of nodes, both in Southern California, where you just have very little new land for growth, so most of the land, most of the development is directed towards infill development. And areas like Portland, where on top of just the scant land, there have, you know, issues like urban growth boundaries, which are, you know, planning tools to help, again, divert or rather look at that growth from a more sustainability perspective. And then the other thing that we talk about is places like Dallas, where while they're not land constrained in any way, they're starting to change their growth patterns in response mainly to these changing demographics and preferences.
Fred, are you seeing what are you seeing in Portland that fits into the sort of megapolitan trend? What's sort of the long term growth projection that you're facing?
Well, we're expecting over the next 30 years a increase of about 1 million people population-wise. That's against about a 1.6 million base. So substantial amounts of increase. And although it is still a very hotly debated issue, the question is, can we do that on our current footprint? And the answer that's at least as a beginning recommendation from our Metropolitan Planning Organization is, yes, we can do it in that existing footprint. That really does mean that we have to do more infill. We have to be able to provide for greater density, and we have to be able to provide for communities and neighborhoods in which people want to live. I'm convinced we can achieve that, but it's not going to be easy. We also find that design, good design, can make a otherwise criticized project for density to be able to be much more acceptable. And so I think we ought to also, and this is part of the role of architects, and that is to be able to really make that design be attractive, interesting elements. I would also say that in one of our most dense neighborhoods, partly one that has just been created out of an old brownfield, but also connected to one of our older neighborhoods, happens to be a neighborhood in which I live as well. What we see when we have that kind of density is that people are 11 and a half times more likely to walk for a trip that otherwise in our region they'd have to drive. And again, our region as a whole is pretty sensitive to these issues, but 11 and a half times more likely to walk, 4.5 times more likely to take public transit, and 2.5 times more likely to be able to actually take a bike.
What I find myself wondering is whether these kinds of communities, I mean, they're very rooted in a local ethic and in a lot of attention to specific qualities on a small scale, and isn't that's almost a complete reversal of the longer-term historic trend that we see in cities that cultivate a sort of fluidity, like Cade was initially talking about, a kind of cosmopolitanism, a kind of the idea that you can reach out and get access to and have a certain kind of physical freedom. We're really, it sounds, at least in the Portland case, and perhaps, Cade, you want to talk about this more generally, What are some of the other implications of the relocalizing that that we're starting to see?
Well, I think the best way to think about it, and Fred alluded to this, is how we're going to grow. You know, as a country, we're going to have something like, you know, 50% more population over the next 40 to 50 years. And although it's sometimes hard to think of that given the current recession, that's going to be the case. And how we organize the patterns of settlement and living for a country that is that much larger than the one we have today is critically important to maintaining a good lifestyle and, as Fred said, to maintaining community, because transportation is a means to an end. It's not the end itself. What we really want is for people to be able to do the things that we need to do and that we want to do in our daily lives. And if we can do that through building in ways that require shorter distances to accomplish those things, whether it be going to school or going to the shop or going to visit a friend or whatever we may choose to do and need to do. If we have closer proximity to those things, then density becomes not a bad word, but it becomes a different word. It becomes convenience. And when we have that kind of convenience, if we do it with the right kind of architecture and design, which Fred also alluded to, and I couldn't agree more with him about the importance of that, then I think we can deliver the same sorts of things that people have been seeking in sprawling suburbs, but in ways that are more environmentally benign and in ways that will continue to satisfy us, you know, as we look for places to live and work and shop and go to school.
One of the themes that came out of the exhibition and that Susan Piedmont-Palladino and I tried to heighten in the book is this idea that the pursuit of green community involves wrestling with a number of wicked questions and issues that don't have simple solutions or that are easy to articulate in one way but very hard to implement in another. And I think when we think about planners' roles in approaching green community, that it's the implementation where you really see the problems and the challenges. So I wonder if each of you would respond to that. What is the optimal role of the planner? I noticed all three of you are taking growth as a given or as something that we have to plan for. Do planners have a role to actively combat growth?
I'll step in at least here first. I think that it seems very attractive at times to be able to talk about, you know, just shut the door after the last person who got here moved here and stop it all. We recognize that in this country, you know, the level of freedom we expect is, you know, that just doesn't really happen. And although there are ways to be able to limit growth by different policies, it seems to me that those are really counterproductive. I think the challenges that we're going to be facing as a nation, particularly with climate change, I mean, if in fact large parts of our country in the southern part become less inhabitable, then it seems to me that our, you know, a part of our issues are going to be, you know, how do we in the rest of the country really absorb parts of our the population of our country. So what to me is an issue is not that planners should in fact be trying to be able to stop that growth, but rather to be able to recognize that we need to do it and do it smartly. And I think that is a very real part of giving people what they want. And I do want to come back to the issue. It's, some people refer to it as social engineering. What I think I find that to be so wrong-headed is people are wanting to be able to find alternatives to being stuck in that automobile in a neighborhood that they can't get to anything but by driving, and that we are really trying to give people some level of choices. And in that process, it is more economical. That is, the transportation costs can be less, the ability to be able to enjoy time with their family.
families, with friends. All of those things are enhanced by being able to be in a neighborhood that's walkable, that's bikeable, and that still has the ability to get around by automobile.
I would add to that, in terms of the role of planning, that I really think that we could be coming into a new golden age of planners and planning, because the challenges that we face can also be sort of redefined as opportunity, and the opportunity for imagination and for problem solving in an era where we've got different environmental constraints now than we may have had 50 years ago, I think presents just, you know, some wonderful opportunities for the planning profession to step up and help create the kinds of communities, whether they're in inner city communities, and we have a great deal of revitalization that we can accomplish there, or whether it's suburban communities. I think that planners can play a huge role in fashioning this sort of sustainable future. If I were a planning student right now, I would be really looking forward to being able to participate in that.
I completely agree. I think, you know, I've focused my own studies on urban design as well, and I think both from a design standpoint and a planning standpoint, one of the keys to accommodate growth is to really both adaptation and stability in design. You know, from the respective adaptation, that's already been occurring when you look at, for example, the issue of dead and failing malls. We've lots of first-ring suburbs or older suburbs have already looked at that as an opportunity and transformed that into new mixed-use communities that are thriving, that are, you know, renewed centers for those communities. And within that adaptation, we have to think about flexibility in design for new retail concepts, for new ways of living, for new ways of gathering and fostering social interaction that allow for dynamic communities. Because I think that moving forward, we really should be anticipating or just expecting change. And I think that's one of the things that led us to where we are right now. We expected, for example, the automobile to be, you know, the most convenient way to move from point A to point B, and we're starting to see that that's not the case. And it's not even the most desirable from both a climate and a health perspective. So I think it's just really important to, you know, really think about both human beings and the society in which we live in as a dynamic one, and planners need to take that into account when they're looking forward.
I'm just stunned by the volume of optimism coming through here. I hope that it all translates into real policy and real implementation and real change.
Well, I think that you know, if you look at the examples that were presented in the Green Community exhibit at the Building Museum and reflected in the book, you'll see reason for that optimism, because the communities where some of these challenges are being met by some very gifted planners and architects and developers represent places that are incredibly desirable places to live, and in many instances people are willing to pay premiums to live in them, so that one of the challenges becomes, you know, how do we build in affordability in these communities, because right now there's not enough of them to supply the market demand for that kind of lifestyle. And as Mary Ellen alluded earlier, given future demographic trends, the types and numbers of people that are going to prefer these kinds of communities is only going to increase. So I think that there's just lots of reason for optimism and for sort of applied creativity now. I think it's a pretty exciting time.
I mean, I would even add to the optimism that I've always been a half, you know, glass half full kind of person. I think the recession is a great opportunity for us planners too, because it slows down the types of development that were happening without really looking forward to how are they going to evolve and what do these new types of places mean, and also the conventional kind of development, to really just incorporate a broader holistic view of how to really develop for a sustainable green community. From the mission standpoint, I think that's an opportunity for planners and designers.
I think when you look at some of the communities that are in the exhibit, you know, when you look at Highlands Garden Village in Denver, or you look at Atlantic Station in Atlanta, or you look at Greensburg in Kansas, or Stella in Missouri, I mean, this is all over the country. We haven't even gotten to, you know, Arlington and Portland, you know, places that are really shining examples. I think it's pretty easy to see models out there to follow, to build upon, and improve. And I think that one of the great services that the Building Museum and APA have provided with this exhibit and book is to point out that these things can not only be done, but they can be done in ways that are beautiful and immensely appealing.
I might add one specific concrete thing that I think kind of highlights the changing attitudes that are existing across the country. We utilized some of our stimulus money to be able to do work on some bike paths and other things and related to biking. And there was some criticism from members of Congress from other parts of the country about, you know, wasn't this some form of a waste, the idea that biking was really just for recreation. Our response is a very clear fact that biking is a transportation mode here in the Portland region, and I think that's growing across the country. The fundamentals of how people are changing, how they want to be able to get around, isn't necessity. It is about a choice that they are making, and I think that, given that we have a bit under 10% of our trips in the Portland area being by bike for commute work, is, I think, just underscores that. So one small example of how much of a shift is occurring, and that is a part of what gives me the sense of real optimism for the country as a whole.
Even in Chicago, we're seeing people who bike all through the winter now, so there may really be something going on out there.
Are you one of those people, Tim?
Not yet. No, we have this lovely thing called the L, and it's a little more enclosed than the average bicycle. So I want to thank Kate Benfield, Fred Hansen, and Mariella Alfonso for joining us. Thanks to all of you. The book is Green Community. It's available through APAPlanningBooks.com.